This meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you for joining the IDN Guidelines Working Group call on 25th of January 2018. We have Mats, Dennis, Edmund, Carl, Satish, Pitinan, and Sarmat on the call. So over to you, Mats.
Thank you. Good to see that we are quite a few people today. Let's scroll down to where we stopped last time. So, or maybe we should stop here. I mean, we talked about automatic activation. Let's see.
Yeah, that's BC6.
BC6, yes. So, so Edmund is here, we see here some criticism of having automatic activation. So, Edmund, what do you say about that we remove the automatic activation possibility in the guidelines? Over to you, Edmund.
Yeah, Edmund here. Thank you, Matt. Obviously, I think it is a I don't have the actual comment in front of me. I guess we can respond to it, but in terms of activating the variants, I think there is a lot of probably a lot of misunderstanding of how that's done. But overall, I think the key aspect of it is that it has been a fundamental part of the CDNC approach, and it has been proven to be beneficial for users. I think, you know, we can probably point back to some of the studies there. But also, I think one of the issues, if I remember correctly, one of the, you know, in the earlier draft, we provided a longer description of how to mitigate some of the issues. We have, I think, since removed part of it because of some comments. The question now is, I don't think, is whether to think about whether or not to include allowing preferred variants or auto variants or whatever you call it, but rather whether we go back to providing a longer explanation of the issues to deal with. And rather than, you know, or not. So I think that's the pertinent discussion itself that we should have. Should we go back to specifying a little bit more, which we did in the earlier draft, or do we go with what we have? I think what we originally discussed in the comment that we received was that there is no need for that specificity. But I think perhaps in light of the further comment, somewhere in between is something that we might want to shoot for.
So one of the issues is the number of variants that can be activated automatically.
So there are ways that registries can manage that. I think any reasonable registry with any competence will probably, you know, work on processes to deal with that. You know, if a particular registration creates, you know, millions of delegations, then obviously it is a matter of a policy that is not dealt with properly, not the fact that it is the preferred variant being, you know, like simplified Chinese, traditional Chinese being activated for the registrant. So yeah, I think those are items which we have, that's why I say, you know, we either go back to the original, which had a much longer, explanation of some of the things that we should, take care of, someone wants to, you know, the registry needs to, implement the preferred variant, policy, or, you know, versus the later draft, which, removes those. So, I think what we should try to aim for again is somewhere in between.
Paul?
Thanks, Manson. I think I mostly agree with what Edmund was saying, and I'd like to reiterate, as someone who has written some of this code, that limiting the total number of variant allocations it's somewhat trivial and reasonably common in this kind of space. So I think it might be a little bit naive to think that there would truly be millions of variants, and I would question the competence of a registry that actually had that kind of system, or allowed for it, rather. The other thing I was reading between the lines, I suppose, with their comment was that they feel that more variants equals more abuse, and I'm not entirely convinced that they are connected, but perhaps there's some kind of middle ground where, and I'm hesitant to put restrictions on IDNs that don't apply to regular domains, but perhaps there is a way that we could essentially suggest or guide registries that they have a shared fate with all their other domains. So if a domain is found to be abusive, and that happens to be an active variant of another domain, perhaps it's the primary domain, and perhaps not. But whatever action is taken at the registry to respond to that abuse applies to all active variants, and potentially active. So if they're not active at the time and they were made active, then any restriction or delegation to a black hole server would apply to that, to all of the collection of variants for that particular name. That might be one way of reducing the risk, as the BC see it. I see that Sarmat has his hand up, so I'll see if he's got more to add to this.
Yes, Sarmat, please.
Thank you. I think the concern which Board IDN Working Group also showed in their comments, which are also listed later in this document, and BC6, is, so I'm just going to read the relevant portion of this comment in BC6, is that as currently stated, the exception seems overly broad and potentially threatens to swallow the rule limiting IDN variant label allocations. So I think there are two dimensions to it at least. One is that there is no restriction on the scripts for which this can happen. And then there is also no restriction on the number of variants which can be automatically activated. The issue obviously comes as actually documented by in SAC's SAC 60 report, where they clearly point out that there is a real manageability issue which can come with too many variants, and that impacts registries, registrars, and registrars. That's what SAC says. So there's a, you know, that's what I guess we, what these comments are suggesting we address. So I guess at least if we can have some guidance in these two dimensions and not leave it totally open, that may actually help. But that's just a bit of background. Thank you.
I put myself in the queue. Yeah, so one possibility would be to state that you update the guideline to state that if a registry has automatic activation, it must have a limit on the number of variants that are activated, and state that limit must be put fairly low. And secondly, we could of course, I mean, saying a definite number is quite arbitrary, so I'm hesitant of doing that. When it comes to scripts, etc., it is of course possible to state what scripts that may have automatic activation, but I'm hesitant of doing that. But we could have some language stating that it should only be done or be used in communities where there is already a tradition of automatic activation. Let's see, Carl, please.
Yeah, I put my hand up just to speak about that last comment. I'm hesitant to restrict it to those communities that have it today or have had it in the past and not offer it to the IDN communities that, for whatever reason, have not been served until now and might be just establishing their presence on the internet. We certainly don't want an arbitrary time-based restriction on this kind of rule. I think so long as automatic variant activation is limited, and we could change some text to say that, but the operator must place a sensible limit on there, but not actually put a figure on there. And so long as the variants themselves share a fate with each other, so that you can't use one variant to escape the outcome of a previous abusive variant, then I'm not aware of any other abusive vector. Pretty much all the suggestions and concerns have been either the volume or the mere fact that a variant could be present when activated without a prior warning. And I haven't heard a clear case as to why those are security risks. And I speak as someone who operates several TLDs that do that, that actually have active automatic active variants. So, and that is including the SSAC doc. Which I was very disappointed with. And
thank you, Carl. I think that you second a proposal of having requiring the registry to put a limit. When it comes to limiting to certain community with traditions, I agree with you. I don't think it's a good idea, but we must say something. So instead requiring that variants always must share the same DNS delegation, is that a reasonable limitation and something that maybe decrease the risks of the variants. Hands up, I think, yeah, Edwin, please.
Thank you, Matt. So yeah, I think I agree with what was said earlier by Cal and yourself. I think we could definitely add back some parameters. I think as I hear Samad about the BC comment, it really goes to the point that I mentioned. It seems like our first draft had a lot of description. And I think RYSG came back and say, you know, that's too much specificity. Now VC is saying, you know, it's too broad. I think, you know, we should put a little bit of parameters and one or two pointers, having mechanisms to limit the total number of automatically activated ones. That's certainly something that we could advocate for. And that should, I think, address the issue. I think, in terms of response specifically to BC's, note, I think we could, point them back to the earlier, draft and also, note that, you know, we take that and we will, you know, provide some parameters back, included back into the guidelines.
So what parameters do you suggest that we should add back?
Right. So the one particular that is discussed here is the mechanism to have some limitations to the volume. But I think, you know, there were, I think, three or four points he included in the first draft. I don't recall them exactly right now, but when we go to actually working out the final text, we could pick from there or you know, summarize those or in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, but Edwin, we have a discussion right now. So what factors do you think are reasonable to have to include?
If I recall, there were three or four points, right? So there were, you know, pointing to the FSAC document, pointing to the CDNC implementation as a example, and based on all the studies that were done for it, I don't recall whether we pointed specifically to the IDN study report, the variant issues project study report, but that's another point. I think we also point to a more in-depth community input to that, and I forgot which three or four items, but out of those, I think we can revive a couple of the points or, you know, make them more concise to avoid the early comment that there was too much specification, but you know, to also address the current comment that it's overly, you know, it's overly broad. I guess that's my point.
Thank you. Salman, please.
So I posted or pasted the early version of the guideline from the previous public comment in the chat box, but I'm actually going to just quickly pick up the two, three points which were listed in there. Basically, it said that in cases registry stride approach, which means automatic activation, the registry must carefully take into consideration the security and stability impacts as advised by the SAC documents, different user experience perspectives from the user experience report. And then the third was the IDN variant issues project final integrated issues report, the IDN policies and LGRs adopted by respective communities and evidenced operational experiences. So those were the five conditions. However, I think it still did not come. So it's actually asking for conservatism, but it is leaving the conservatism to the registries to decide. And I guess a question is that then is it, you know, if the registries are basically eventually going to make a decision on this, is there, do we need, you know, how is this totally left to the registries, or do you think there is needs to be some check and balance there at all? Thank you.
Yeah, I think that the former text is too broad and open. It doesn't really give a guideline to the reader. I think that we should have something more specific, if we should have something, so that the reader can from the guideline see what it should do. It's quite clear here that I think we agree that we should put some effort into guidelines 12, or guideline 12, and have something, some more limitation. Maybe we should break it out, because I remember that it was very long text, and if we get long again, then we might want to have more than one guideline, so it's not too long. So how do we proceed from this? Edmund, could you write something which puts a limitation on automatic activation, but not more a limitation than you think is reasonable for the communities that you know of. So Edmund has accepted that. It's okay, from the chat box. So yeah. So this is guideline 12. Anyone else want to say something? Add to this. Satish, you haven't commented this. Kyle has raised his hand. Please.
Thanks, Matt. I just wanted to point out that we should probably agree on the response. If Edmund is going to be making some substantive changes to the guideline, we might want to suggest that we've received their feedback, and we'll hopefully alter the guidelines in a way that meets their concerns.
So, well, the response then is that we agree with them that the current language is very broad, and that we are looking to revising it to have more guidelines on keeping automatic activation on a reasonable level. Does that sound good for the time being? Okay. Samad, did you catch that?
Yep, I have that. I'll actually go and review the recordings and document it. Thank you.
Thank you. So, we concluded, I think we concluded BC. So,
yes,
we did. So, AB is the next, and AB is, let me see, Anton Bursansky at University of Illinois. So AB1, so you know that the IDN tables are more numerous than necessary and sometimes redundant. As an example, a Hebrew TMB has 97 IDN tables, including Ukrainian, which is not very usable being a different script, and which is, in turn, entirely included in Cyrillic. So it may be recommended to remove retired IDN tables that are proper subsets of other tables, or better yet, not use overly permissive tables. Further, Cyrillic contains code points similar to Latin, so it may allow hieroglyphs to some non-IDN second-level labels for the TLD. Mean none. Must be none.
Sorry, that may actually be a typo. I'll fix that.
Yes. Yes.
Non-IDN.
Right. So in the new DTLD program, there are a number of TLDs with around 100 IDN tables. So I guess that Anton has looked at one of those with a number of 97. We don't have any comment about the number of IDN tables or something, I think, in our guidelines. Should we have that?
I guess we'll have to see whether this has an impact on the objectives of the guidelines.
So, can you elaborate?
Yes, so let me actually very quickly open a web page and read it across rather than try to make it up. So the guidelines are focused on IDN registration policies and practices that are designed to minimize the risk of cyber squatting and consumer confusion and respect the interests of local languages and character sets. So that's sort of the focus, and I guess the comment is actually quite interesting and quite useful. I guess one of the things to discuss would be whether, even though what is being pointed out is quite reasonable, whether that does fit the guidelines scope. I guess that would be probably a good place to start. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Samad. So one could say that the guidance comes in after the IDN tables have been decided for the tea leaf. But on the other hand, we talk about mixing of different scripts, etc., and that is part of the creation of table phase. So I feel that these guidelines actually go in where at the state at the phase where the tables are set for the community. So I think that we could also have a guideline on this. I don't think we should, but I'd say that we could. Sum up, please.
Thank you. So, so yes, there are certainly two parts or three parts of this comment. One, talking about just the numerosity of the IDN tables. The second one, where there are multiple IDN tables for the same script, one or some being subsets of others. And then obviously the third one, which is talking about homoglyphs and cross-script confusables. For the last one, last comment, I think we already have some guidelines which are addressing those, which are about whole script confusables and not allowing mixing of scripts and so on. For the first two comments, I'm just trying to think again whether those comments, so if a GTLD or a TLD offers multiple IDN tables, even if it's 97, for example, question is, does that impact the confusability of end user? Because, you know, and the only one way I can think of, for example, at this time, is that if there are two multiple tables for the same, if I can generate the same label through multiple tables, but I get different, for example, sets of variants, if I use one table versus another table, that can potentially cause end-user confusion. Beyond that, I'm not really sure. I guess we need to think a bit more. Thank you.
Thank you. Carl?
Yeah, thanks. So, and I was having the same problem with the issue here, insofar as I don't quite understand why this is perceived as a problem, because a user only interacts with a domain, the domain in front of them, not the potential domains that may or may not exist. It's the ones that they do see. And so long as our guidelines restrict any overlap or visually similar, which I think we've covered in quite detail, so you cannot have another label in the TLD, regardless of which table it might have come from, that is visually similar or confusing to the one that you're currently interacting with, then as far as the user is concerned, it is still unique, which is the key. So the fact that there may or may not be larger or smaller individual script or language tables present within the TLD is immaterial to the user experience, because they deal with each domain uniquely, rather than it's only we who peek behind the curtain. Everyone else needs to react to what they see. And I think that might be the conflation of issues here, that it is certainly challenging to create client software that branches in 97 different directions for a particular TLD. It's not that challenging for an individual to deal with one domain in one of those languages. And in general, I would prefer not to restrict tables or languages to TLDs for no good reason, or simply to reduce what a human might perceive as load, because ultimately we expect to offload a lot of the processing and table and the dealing with tables mechanically. So I don't see any strong benefit other than academic ease.
Dennis?
Thank you. This is Dennis. Yeah, I support Carl's comments and also Sarmat's. And I think more specifically to Sarmat's point, I think we're already dealing with what I think he talked about, the harmonization of IDN tables. When you have SenseScript tables across one single TLD, we need to harmonize Boolean rules across all those tables, so there are no overlap as to Booleans going to different registrants. Thank you.
Thank you. So, sum up, please.
Yes, thank you. And yes, I'm just seconding Dennis's comment here that I was also thinking that we actually have this harmonization requirement now, which is new, which is precisely for this kind of issue, to manage this kind of issue where you can actually have different kind of sets of variants generated through different tables, and this is a good example. So we actually are dealing with eventually end user issues which are generated, if they are generated through this process. So we can actually, as a response point to that, we actually have these particular recommendations in the context of harmonization and also cross-script homoglyphs and mixing of scripts, which deal with any particular issues which may arise on the user end because of these tables. But beyond that, you know, as far as the scope of work is concerned, you know, I don't really see on the user side, if there are more tables, how that could, for example, cause confusion. Thank you.
Thank you. A response to this is that we cover the risk of confusion in, maybe we should point out the recommendations that we have. So it's 14, 15, 16, 17. And somewhere with the variants, I don't find it right now. So that would be the response to AB1. So that we don't feel that the number of table is creates any risk. Or the high number of tables creates a risk as such. Is that the reasonable answer? Carl writes 14 and 15. Yes, but,
number 13 is also relevant. Number 13 is harmonization of variant rules across same script IDN tables.
Right. So I would say 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. Handles the issues that he brings up. Can we respond in that way? Okay, so let's go to AB2. So he states that it could register home script Cyrillic homoglyph in a GTLD for usual ASCII domain label, get a valid TLS certificate for it, and proxy all HTTP traffic to redirect to the homoglyphs in HTTPS. Okay. Do we cover the ASCII situation? freely? Or should we say that it's implicit in the guideline? Do we specifically say something about asking?
Not these days, I don't think so.
So maybe we should have a comment on this, that the confusion between ASCII and some IDMs must be taken into account.
Matt, this is Dennis again. We don't
talk
specifically about ASCII, but we do have a recommendation or guideline that talks about whole script confusable. I believe that,
right.
Let me look at my...
That's 17.
17, yes.
Yeah. So, maybe we should add there that ASCII domain names should also be taken into account in this respect. Carl?
I was just going to say that the RFCs cover this regarding homoglyph restrictions, and I'm fairly certain we included those in the guidelines. So it was one of the reasons why we didn't end up referring to the confusables text because we felt that was too broad, but the standard homoglyph, especially around Cyrillic languages, is covered in the RFCs. I'm actually just looking for the specific RFC now, but I'm reasonably certain we included it in the guidelines.
I don't think that the RFCs talk about those homoglyphs, but we refer to Unicode report, technical report 39, all script confusable. So, the question is if we should say that this also applies to ASCII, since we otherwise only talk about IDM. I mean, this is for IDM, but it has a connection to an ASCII-only domain name.
Max, this is Dennis. Sorry for the quick interruption.
Yes.
ASCII is Latin.
Right. Yes, but it's not IDM. That's the complexity. So, Mom, please.
Right, so I put it in the chat box as well. It could actually be just a issue of registry not managing whole script confusables rather than the issue with the wording of the recommendation itself.
Can you say that once again, please?
Right. So the example given for a particular TLD, it could really be an issue that particular GTLD is not managing that particular recommendation properly, rather than an issue with the recommendation itself. So the recommendation may actually be okay. Obviously, it will only work if people would follow it. And in this particular case, that particular GTLD may not be following the recommendation. So just because I guess what I'm saying is that do we really think that the recommendation wording is insufficient? Because it's written generically enough that it really should cover all the cases.
Right. So that's why my first statement. So should we point out that this applies also for ASCII, or is that implicit in the recommendation?
So my at least understanding was it was generally applicable to all contexts, including Latin and including, of course, ASCII within Latin, because it also refers to TR-39, which is, I guess, a broad document, TR-36 and 39. And they're not restricted themselves only to non-ASCII characters.
Well, of course not. I mean, from a Unicode standpoint, the A to Z is nothing special. But this document is about IDN, and does this also cover ASCII domain names if they are confusable with IDN? Is that implicit from the guidelines, or should we make it explicit? So that's my question. I see that nobody thinks that we should make it explicit. So then Dennis, please first.
Thank you, Max. Yes, I don't think we have to. I mean, it's apple and oranges, right? I know that ASCII is also now speaking interchangeably with ASCII and Latin. ASCII is the encoding system, whereas Latin is a script. What we refer to ASCII is really a subset of the Latin script. So the case where let's say a TLD only offers a Cyrillic IDN table, he's also allowed to register domain names in the Latin script, but only in the subset of A to Z, right? So the guideline is written in a way that it will cover that TLD, even if it's only offering Cyrillic IDNs.
Okay. So, yeah, that was my question, if it really does, because the ASCII is not IDN. That's why. But if you feel that it's implicit from our guidelines, we should just answer AB that thank him for the comment, and that is covered by the guidelines, and point that at actually the same guidelines as before. Carl.
Sorry, I was just going to write that the mixing scripts advice does come quite clear in TR-36, which we've either included directly or via RFC 5890, which refers to it.
Okay.
So, and there's nothing wrong, I think, with strengthening that advice, but I think it's quite clear, and it does refer quite specifically to Cyrillic as an issue. So,
okay.
I think it's covered by our guidelines, but I guess there's no harm in talking about it more if we wish to.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if you suggest that we should update the guideline or that we don't have to. Call. If you're talking.
I was just had to unmute. I was just quickly checking. I'm trying to look to see if we did in fact include TR-36 in our guidelines, and I don't think I've got a current copy of it. I've got a draft, and it may not be included in there.
We point to TR 39, but not TR 36.
Okay. Do we include 5890? Because I know that RFC 5890 actually refers specifically to TR 36. Although that's probably around.
Right. 5890 is explicitly included because we are saying that registries must adhere to IDNA 2008 now.
Right, but we don't, not in the context of homoglyphs or confusables. We don't refer to that.
Then. Yeah, well, then perhaps we should include TR36 explicitly rather than, you know, relying on a reference in an RFC.
So TR39 and TR36 are actually almost the same thing. They're two aspects of the same thing, where TR36 is more about defining the cases and TR39 is more on algorithmically, you know, handling those cases. So I think either one is fine. What we could do is just add TR36 and 39 in this guideline just to keep it more explicit. Would that work?
Yes, I think that would work. So in recommendation 17, we could refer to both. So the answer to on ABT is that this problem is already covered by the guidelines, and but we will look at the possibility of being more explicit in our references. Is that a good answer? Okay. Thank you. Time is running. Next is the registries stakeholders group, RISIG. Where is the wire from? French abbreviation. So, RISIG 1, so they state that guideline 8 fails to define what constitutes a secure and or stable issue, and who decides whether an IDN table does in fact pose any issues. Okay. We had previously some definition of security. We removed that. So, yes, Samad, please.
Just to remind everybody, basically in the first draft which we released, we actually had a specific security and stability definition that was taken verbatim from the RCEP document, but based on feedback, we in the second document took out those definitions and said that we will use security and stability generically and inherit their use and definition from the respective registry contracts where security and stability is defined. That was basically the motivation behind taking this out. Obviously, as far as the security and stability of an IDN table is concerned, that is undertaken through the PDT and RCEP process. So that's so question in response to the question on who decides whether an IDN table has security or stability issues, that would be obviously undertaken through the process defined for PDT and RSEC. Thank you.
So one possibility would be that we in our recommendation number 8 state that if the TLD is under a contract with ICANN, the definition of secure stability in that contract will rule what constitutes a stable and secure IDN implementation. What do you say about that?
One thing which we all, I think, agreed to was that we should not have our own definition of security and stability. Thank you.
Right. But then we don't have that. So if we explicitly refer to definitions in the contract, then we don't have our own definition. So about again.
Sorry, but I think that may also not work because these guidelines are also for CCTLDs, which do not actually have contracts. So
right.
Unfortunately, that wouldn't carry across.
I say that if it has contract with ICANN, then. But I agree with the problem. Edmund, please.
Yeah, sorry. I somewhat distracted, so I was jumping, you know, in and out. So I might be speaking out of context. But specifically on this issue, I feel that in response to ROISG, we should just point them to say that, hey, your RA doesn't specify that either. Well, not in that tone or language, but just pointed to that, you know, the documentation don't have. We don't. And note their comment, and we think, you know, it's kind of appropriate to do this, because it also straddles both GTLDs and CCTLDs. But on this particular point, if in response to ROISG, we should say, you know, probably let them know that their definitive documents also don't have the specification. That's why we took the same approach, so that it's consistent. And I don't think we need to make any, at least on this point, I think we don't need to make any changes to the guidelines.
So, the response of this comment would then be that, if the relevant contract defines secure stability, that will also be valid for these guidelines. Is that an answer back? We are at the top of the hour. Edmund, do you want to say something, please? Last word? No. Okay.
Nothing.
I think that we continue here. Think about RISIG 1 and till next week, and we continue there. Unless someone wants to say something finally, thank you very much for today, and talk to you next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.